Some people think if you go to church, you leave your brain home. Not here. And what I do today is personally one of the more difficult messages, and give me a hair more, Joe, one of the more difficult messages that I preach. Too much. Because there is so much that could be said, as last Sunday, and I have to condense it down into these few moments. In order to do it, you have to reach up and grab your brain and tune in and work hard with me as I make a statement about the historic bases for a faith in Jesus Christ as God. I've heard people saying throughout my church history, you ask me how I know he lives. He lives within my heart. That's valid for you. Doesn't mean a thing to anyone else. The New Testament faith began with a declaration of fact. The second chapter of the book of Acts opens when the day of Pentecost was fully come. They were all of one accord in one place. Suddenly there came a sound from heaven as of a rushing mighty wind. And the passages that follow are the bases for the Pentecostal and charismatic revivals of recent years. But eventually from that upper room they're down on the street. And a great multitude gathered, saying that these men are drunken. And suddenly Peter stood to his feet and addressed the mob, and addressed the accusation of drunkenness. Said, these men are not drunken, as you suppose. And then he began to preach a fact. He said, Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God by miracles and wonders and signs, which ye yourselves also know. So they didn't have to pluck their eyes out or turn their ears off or end their thinking apparatus. He started where they were, and he said, this Jesus that performed these things, which ye yourselves also know, him ye have taken with wicked hands of crucified and slain. All that encompassed facts they were well aware of in that city. Then he introduced the next astounding fact, whom God hath raised up, having loosed the pains of death, and began to declare the witness of that fact. The Apostle Paul, writing to the Corinthians, said, I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, 15th chapter, 1 Corinthians, how that, and he goes through the record of Christ's life and death according to Scriptures, and then on the third day he says, rose. He names the witnesses. Individuals, small groups, and then he says witnesses can be assembled, including an appearance to above 500 brethren at one time, of whom most of those, the 500, are dead or asleep, as he referred to it, but a greater part remain unto this day. In short, the Christian testimony hinged upon a declaration of a fact. Totally astounding. I've stood on platforms where this church is gathered and pointed out that the usual approach to this astounding claim of the resurrection is to argue in a circle. The resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur, therefore anyone who says it did is a poor reporter because they're reporting the impossible, thus they shouldn't be believed because the resurrection didn't occur, because it can't occur, and anybody says it did, lying, obviously, so don't bother to read them, because the resurrection can't occur, therefore it didn't occur. Shouldn't even say it did, because it's impossible, but because the resurrection can't occur, didn't occur, for that reason, nobody arguing in a circle. The Christian says a resurrection cannot occur by any concept that I know, and if you add to the fact that the one that Christianity is claiming came out of that tomb, that he went about making the claims that we outlined last Sunday, claims impossible for a respected, intelligent, mortal man to make about himself, including the claim that if you slew him, he would raise again. If that man who went about making those claims actually came out of that tomb, then it's time to take another look at him. And as I said in the closing of last Sunday's preparation for this message, I don't really need some of the proofs that other people demand for God. I don't need to know that he's personal and it's the nature of a person to reveal himself, and you therefore look for the revelation and you find the word, etc. I don't need a God. He doesn't exist. Just soon struggle with the problems alone. I don't need a moral argument. I think Confucius' ethic is better than Jesus. He says, don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. That's safe. I've been the victim too long of some Christians doing to me what they want done to themselves. Be my guest and do to yourself what you want done to you. Don't do it to me. Practically speaking, I'm with Confucius. I don't need a first cause. My mind has no difficulty at all living with infinite regression. But if this man who made the claims that Jesus made about himself also came out of that tomb and sailed off in the blue as they preached, equally a part of the message of miraculous claims, then I'm going to take another look at Jesus the Christ. I have shucked off most of the traditions of Christianity throughout the years to fall into the category of Jesus' condemnation when he said, we make void the word of God because of our traditions. But I've come to appreciate, since studying the resurrection and returning to a fresh look at Christ, John's insight when he talked of the one, the Greek word was logos, that in that Greek philosophic frame where they accepted any personal God at all, logos was the unknown mediator between God and man, and this logos that was with God and could tell us all that we need to know about God, in marvelous Greek phraseology, struck a tent in human flesh, named Jesus of Nazareth, from a military term, just moved into that tent and brought God's nature from behind the curtain with the statement that no man has seen God, but Christ hath declared him. The word is exegesis in the Greek, which means to lead from behind the curtain and put on display. That this one who made the claims last Sunday, who verified his right to those claims by the resurrection, is the place I must look to see God led from behind the curtain of unknowingness onto the street where ordinary people live, is what has captured me about Christ. And for 3.5 years, I had to settle the issue of the resurrection myself. If he came out of that tomb, I could not be released from this focus on Jesus the Christ. Now, my undergraduate major was history. Let me make a statement. By definition, there is no such thing as historic certainty. Because by definition, historic certainty means all logically, not just practically and operationally, all logically available evidence is in. Which means by definition, historic certainty can only be relative once the event has passed. Because logically there are eyewitnesses, in reality you can't be, for a past historic event. So all you can ever have logically is probability in historic certainty. But psychological certainty is another matter. Why attorneys play tricks in the courtroom. They say something, the judge says, coming out of his seat, strike that from the record. One attorney jumps up, I object, Your Honor, sustained, strike that from the record, erase your mind, jury, don't even think about it ever again, you know that's impossible. Exposure produces a psychological reaction. You cannot help but have a reaction when you've been exposed to certain facts. My quarrel with most people who reject the resurrection, as said, is that they do it on an a priori position, it can't happen. Seldom, if ever, Do they expose themselves to the evidence giving relative historic certainty, but on exposure, a fixed psychological reaction? You're going to either at one point decide there's no basis for this belief, or you're going to stay agnostic but leaning one direction or the other, or you're going to come to a point, as I did, there's no other explanation. He came out of the tomb. I'm convinced, not without occasional doubts, but convinced enough in the age-old Niebuhrian concept of faith that, like a man that's myopic and cannot see without glasses and might go through different methods of determining the glasses of his choice somewhere, he must put those glasses on and act on them. And if he bangs his elbows and bumps his shoulder and trips over the door jamb, every time he goes through a door, he's going to abandon the glasses and rework them. But if they orient his frame a little better and he sees more clearly, and as he walks, the glasses work, he then gains more confidence in the glasses. At some point, I had to make the decision to move from agnosticism to trying on the glasses, what if he rose? And my life has been the result of acting on that faith, and this church is the result of acting on that faith. But somewhere you have to look at the evidence to make the decision of what to do with the glasses. And with that long introduction, here we go. Now, you'd like me to tell you one fact, just like that. Just boom. I didn't know that. Now that you've told me, I know that he rose, or I'm not convinced that he can go out to the fiesta. Like I challenged my professor at Stanford University, I said, after being his assistant and years with him, I said, you have taught me to form no conclusions without at least exposure to the evidence. Yet everywhere you go and turn, your life reflects a decision denying the resurrection of Christ, and you haven't demonstrated to me that you've ever even taken a look at the evidence. In perfect honesty, he said. That's right, Gene. Come think of it. Can you give me a good 15-minute source? The answer is no. 3.5 years is going to be condensed right now. Now, the subject is, did he rise? But before you talk about Jesus raising from the dead, you've got to agree he lived. Or else who died to raise? So there are certain facts you take for granted before you discuss other facts. And most people on religion don't want to have to discipline their approach to the subject in this manner. In order for me to get done in less than 5 weeks, 40 hours each, for the discussion of the resurrection, I take certain facts for granted. If you disagree, assume them in fine legal parlance in arguendo. Take for granted these facts are true in order to discuss the resurrection issue. Jesus lived. If you say, I don't believe that, and most people have some unknowing judgment of Schweitzer's great book, The Quest for the Historic Christ, as though he determined one didn't exist. No, he didn't. He just set him in the angel-demonology frame of the New Testament. Very few people today, with historic knowledge, deny that Jesus lived. Even Tacitus, the heathen historian, agrees with that. But if you disagree that he even lived, man, you've given me a lot easier task to demonstrate than to demonstrate that he not only lived, he died and rose. You got to assume with me he was crucified. No religious bias here. I think that some fundamentalist leaders in the Christian frame today would make Caiaphas jealous with their hard-headed, hypocritical, self-righteous approach to things. So there is no playing of some anti-Jew frame here. I do not believe the Jewish people crucified Christ. any more than I think the average Christian is responsible for what Jerry Falwell or Jimmy Swaggart says. But I think that the protection of leadership and the corruption of power produces a kind of leadership that reacts against any threat. We're seeing that in Moscow, Lithuania, tensions today. And the Jewish leaders of that day, whose position was threatened by their rejection of Christ and his criticism of them, they instigated the charge, and the Romans, in their authority, brought about the crucifixion. If you want to argue this point, it's much easier to demonstrate than the resurrection. But I waste no time on that today. My argument assumes that as a fact. After being crucified, he was considered dead. I'm not saying he was dead. He was considered dead. You don't normally put people in a tomb otherwise. He was buried. This is very important, in a known, accessible tomb. Very important that this fact be accepted, because some current theories stand or fall on the unhistorically justified basis of claiming that he was buried in a remote tomb that's ordinary and non-family friends or friends did not have access to. He was buried in a known, accessible tomb. Number five, he was preached. Within 7 weeks, raised, ascended, and that the tomb was empty. All three elements were equally a part of the message. They were inseparable from one another. Those who preached the resurrection, preached the ascension, preached the empty tomb. Again, I'm not debating these facts today. I'm assuming them, except to say each of these are much easier to demonstrate than where we're going. Number six, these same Jewish leaders were more concerned to disprove the message being preached than you and I would be 2,000 years removed. Simple, common logic. If these Jewish leaders brought about, through their influence, the crucifixion, calling him a blasphemer, and if he, in fact, had raised from the dead, where were they? It wasn't just a philosophic issue to them. It was bread, butter, and life. And common sense tells you that there would be more motivation on the part of these people to disprove this message than those of us engaging in an intellectual enterprise 2,000 years later. Number seven, the earliest disciples were persecuted horribly. Persecuted horribly. And the earliest records have them persecuted for preaching this message. They told Peter to shut up and threw him in prison. He said, you hanged him on a tree, desired a murderer to be granted to you, but God raised him up from the dead. Later on, it is true, Nero and Caligula, looking for a scapegoat because of the problems on the Roman emperor's shoulders, began to persecute Christians just because they were a scapegoat and identifiable as different. But all the earliest records, and have somebody close that door back there. Whomever's back here is a security, just close that door, so I can stop the sound from the alley. The earliest records have these preachers persecuted precisely for this message. All they had to do to stop persecution was stop saying Jesus rose from the dead. Last, the tomb was empty. Common sense, follow me. If you were this Jewish leader that brought about the crucifixion, and the preachers were saying he rose from the dead, and you had more concern than anybody to shut that message up, as witness the persecution you were bringing on the disciples, all you had to do to shut them up was go to the tomb. And if the tomb where he was buried was a known accessible tomb, a quick trip to the tomb and the production of a body, and all the preaching was ended right there. That in itself is proof the tomb was empty. Furthermore, you can find the tomb of Abraham. You can find the tomb of David. You can find the tomb of just about every well-loved biblical character. They still debate, where was Jesus buried? It's a fight right now in Jerusalem over it. Two tombs claim the spot. The reason there's a debate and the issue's never been settled is it took four centuries when the artifacts and relics became a part of religious faith before they began to care about where he was buried. They didn't care. There was no, once the tomb was empty, there was no reverence for the place. And it was lost totally from history because there was no body in it. Only 400 years later did they get concerned about finding it, and they still haven't figured out whether it's Gordon's tomb or the other one that they're fighting about in the news today. That tomb was empty. Again, spending more time justifying it, the point of today is, assume these facts. Whether true or not, assume them with me. And your own intelligence tells you those facts are an easier task to demonstrate than that he rose from the dead. Now comes, am I boring you? Now comes the hard part. He rose. History has had to give credence to the preachers, so they came up with theories. The first theory was the disciples stole the body. That's the one that the concern of the Jewish leaders and the fact that the tomb was empty in spite of guards being placed on it and the preaching had to be silenced, so they said the Jews, or rather the disciples, stole the body. Second theory, that the Jewish leaders themselves took the body. Third theory, the Romans took it. Fourth theory, they went to the wrong tomb. Those poor grief-stricken women, in the early morning light, couldn't find the right tomb. They were honest. They thought that they found an empty tomb, but it was the wrong one. Five, all hallucinations, glorified daydreams. The disciples believed they saw Jesus, but they really didn't. Six, resuscitation. That he appeared to be dead, but when they put him in the tomb, the coolness of the tomb resuscitated him, and he came out. That's right, revived. It's easier to spell. Seven, the disciples made the whole story up. They made it up. Having lost faith, bet on the wrong horse, to restore their preeminence and desired leadership, they made this story up and took 7 weeks to do it. Eight, they told the truth. They told what they honestly experienced and saw. Now those eight theories are the kind of muddied thought that usually goes on religious matters. I used to hate as a historian what are called objective historians. Those that wouldn't take sides. It's impossible to study any subject and not take sides. You have a psychological reaction. True objectivity clarifies and recognizes the side you're on, but then can objectively give facts on all sides. You cannot study any subject without the facts compelling a psychological reaction. Now I'm going to take a quick 70-league leap. Again, much easier to demonstrate than what we're going toward. There are only two two possible theories to explain this phenomenon of the birth of Christianity. The disciples lied and made the story up, or the disciples told the truth. And there's no, it's an either or. As all study of any subject brings you to when you expose yourself. Well, how can you say that? Assume these facts, you're down to these two. Disciples stole the body. Well, they're lying then, aren't they? So down goes one. Jewish leaders took the body. If you take these facts for granted, these Jewish leaders more concerned than we are to disprove the theory, do you think they would have hesitated to say, hey, wait a minute, you made a mistake, here's the body. It has no credence, makes no sense, does not go along with facts where they put guards there fearing someone to tell a story or them telling the story the disciples stole it. But even if all those things were credible, the message was not just an empty tomb. The message was ascension and a resurrected body that they partook of food with and talked with. The total message still has these disciples lying. Now, can I explain just once? You can hear the bands out there. Tune in. You can hear them yell. Nobody's going to invade the building. Now that we know what it is, will you stay with me as I pull this down together? Keep your focus here. That the Jewish leaders took the body leaves the disciples still lying on the resurrection and ascension elements of their message. They're still exaggerating, whereas Jewish leaders taking the body might explain, if credible, an empty tomb. It doesn't explain the rest of the message, that the Romans took the body. Jewish leaders' influence on the Roman leaders to bring about the crucifixion, their concern, all the other facts, same credibility, is denied the theory, because the Romans would have stopped the controversy by saying, we took the body. But assume for a moment, the Romans took the body, disciples are still lying, because that only explains the empty tomb. Wrong tomb? Let me speed it up. Go to the right tomb based on these facts, and you explode the preaching. But that still doesn't explain. All it explains is empty tomb. Doesn't explain the rest of the message. They're still lying. Hallucinations? Any psychologist will tell you their state of mind was exactly the opposite of that which is necessary to pre-induce the hallucinations. But again, hallucinations coupled with these facts, Jewish leaders concerned, and the tomb with a body in it, no convergence of facts allows this theory to have credibility. Revived, you don't revive from a Roman crucifixion. But if you did, it's not a weak, emaciated, bleeding, crippled Christ they preach. They preach a vital, living Christ, and they preach the ascension. And resuscitation does not take in the entire message, so they're still lying, and you're down to the two. Took me 3 years to get where we just went in that 12 minutes. I finally came in my spiritual journey to the point that if you take the facts, preconceive them, I took the trouble to settle each of the facts for myself. They're much easier than the resurrection facts. But if those facts are subsumed, you are driven in a corner to another either-or. As last Sunday, I quoted the great Christian philosopher C.S. Lewis in saying, when you look at what Jesus had to say about himself, you're brought to a startling alternate. He was either like a man who thought he was a poached or boiled egg, or he was what he claimed to be. When you study the facts of the resurrection, you are backed into another corner by facts. This whole story is either the product of fraudulent, deceiving minds of disciples who were misleading the world and telling the greatest lie that's ever been perpetrated, or they were simple, honest, reporters of facts to which they were exposed. It took me only about a half a year to a year to settle that issue. And I give it to you in a few moments. There are four reasons why I cannot believe, and you have to take your mind through the steps, and I don't mean to talk down, but you have to park with me at the assumed level. Assuming these facts, you're driven to these two alternatives. That means the resurrection issue stands or falls on the credibility of these witnesses. And there are four reasons why I cannot believe they made it up and perpetrated a fraud. The first took more time than probably any other area of evidence. I'll try to cover it the shortest. It's what scholars call internal evidence, that which reveals the state of mind of the writer inobtrusively. In each of these records that give this report of the resurrection message, and by the way, there's a new book out on the Sinaitic manuscript discovered by an offshoot of the old Alexandrian church. And you got to remember that that was the spawn bed of Gnosticism, who sought to force their leadership position above others because they were confronting the power of apostles who had direct contact with Christ, and they wanted to somehow step out from underneath that mantle. So they would claim individual revelations, and they had less interest in recording the resurrection record than anybody. Now, the Sinaitic is a manuscript found that brings us four centuries away from Christ, and because there's some question of the last few verses of Mark in it, that proves nothing about the earliest record. You go to the earliest records of the church, you have Tatian's Diatessaron in 160 A.D. that put together the four Gospels, and I simply mention it for the scholars present. I'm unconvinced with the argument of the Sinaitic. Back to earlier roots, these records unite. Every one of these apostles telling this story give off a picture internally of honesty rather than craftiness. For example, I preached a few weeks ago to this congregation about Jesus feeding the multitude near Bethsaida. You read in one gospel, pretty much agreed, some Catholic scholars settled this, that Matthew was written at Antioch. Mark, where it was written remains unknown, but it is generally accepted he wrote to Gentiles, either to Rome or to the Gentile Christians around Alexandria in Egypt. Luke, the companion of Paul, he sat down to do a historic study, saying many attempts have been made. There's no denying on his part. He's assembling other records and putting it together. These early writers, each writing in different places, each with different objects, treated as simple historians, in that one famous event where it's claimed Jesus fed the 5,000, you go to one gospel, written in another place, to a different people, you find that Jesus called Philip, and Philip was from a place, Bethsaida. You then go to another gospel, written in another place, to another group of people. If we're going to assume these people are liars and frauds, they had no idea they'd all be assembled in one place. And you find that the place where Jesus was when he performed the miracle of feeding the 5,000 was near Bethsaida. You then go to a third gospel, written by a different man, a different place, and you have what seems inexplicable. In that context, Jesus, looking around the multitude, says, Philip, where do we go to buy bread here? Now, you put all three of them together, it makes sense. Philip was from Bethsaida. The multitude was at Bethsaida. And in the third gospel, Jesus asked Philip, where to buy bread? That diversity, putting together the total story, gives a picture of honest reporting of facts, though each of the different writers reported a different facet of the same fact. One other illustration, when it could go on endlessly. As already said, Mark wrote his gospel to Gentiles, either Egyptians or to Romans. To a Gentile, the phrase Son of Man implies humanity. You say Son of Man to you, you're going to think Son of Man. But to those that were versed, raised, cradled in the Jewish eschatological frame, from the book of Enoch, apocryphal, from the book of Daniel, there was no more messianic, divine phrase than Son of Man, where he was pictured as coming in the clouds of glory to set up his kingdom. But if Mark was a fraud, telling a lie and knew he was lying, writing to Gentiles who never read the book of Enoch, never read the book of Daniel, and he has no scruples because he's a fraud, and it is agreed he's trying to show that Jesus is the Son of God, why not call him that? Why not say to these Gentiles, put it in Jesus' mouth, draw pictures like Doonesbury, Son of God. Instead, count them, go home, count them. Mark's gospel, written to Gentiles who put no theological credence on Son of Man, in Mark's gospel, more than any of the four, Jesus is quoted referring to himself as Son of Man. Now that bespeaks of an honest reporter. If he's a fraud, knows he's a fraud, change the phrase. Even if Jesus said it, have him say Son of God more often and Son of Man less. He does the opposite, which suggests adherence to fact, even though it hurts, the purpose of your writing when put in the frame of the Gentile audience to which it is addressed. Internal evidences of honest reporting. Second, there was a cataclysmic change in each of these individuals after they began to report on this event. You could almost worship the playwright who put the story together if it's not true. Here's Peter, impetuous, unstable, out of line, out of sync most of the time, incapable of even having the courage to stand and be counted when he's surrounded by other disciples. After the telling of this story, all traditions have him unshakable in faith, unbending under persecution, and at the end, embracing his sacrifice with the request to turn him upside down because he's not worthy to be crucified in the same position as his Lord. You have the record thumbnail sketch of James and John, the sons of thunder, they're called. They want the best seat in the kingdom. They would call thunder down from heaven on anybody that opposes them. After the telling of this story, they become incarnation of love and sacrifice. Perhaps the most telling personality sketch is that these who fought for the best seat in the kingdom move into relative obscurity in their own choosing in the traditional records of their ministry thereafter, with one of them being the first martyr of the church. Cataclysmic change in every case for the better, but more telling than any, comes. You can go through all the Gospels and his personality comes out. He's got a brain. He's got a questioning mind. He doesn't take things for granted. They're facing a dangerous journey through Samaria. Thomas pipes up and says, let us go with him. When Jesus says, I must go this way, Thomas says, let us go with him, that we may die with him. Now, you can credit Thomas with courage and devotion, but he actually expected Jesus to be killed on that trip, and he was perfectly willing to go and die with him. Not a very spiritual view of Christ's mission, not a very receptive attitude to Jesus' own statement that no man took his life from him, the shepherd lays his life down. When Jesus is discussing his departure, in the famous passage of Heavenly Mansions, Jesus says, I'm going to go away. I'm going to go to a place. And at that place, I'm going to prepare mansions. And then after I prepare those mansions, I'm coming back and getting you and taking you to be with me in that place. Now, the rest of the disciples, they never lost a beat. They followed him all the way, and when he came to the mansions, they were probably having a charismatic hoedown. I mean, that was wonderful. Well, we're going. Thomas, he hears every word. I'm going to go away. You don't have to be spiritually far out to understand that. I'm going to a place, okay? I'm going to build mansions, okay? I'm going to come back and get you, okay? And whither I go, you know, Jesus said, whither I go, you know, and the way, you know. The rest of them, as I've said, are jumping around with joy, I'm sure. Thomas says, hey, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? You find these in obscure spots. Who is it that is doubting when the story of the resurrection comes? Same God, Thomas. I will not believe until I thrust my hand into the print of the nails and where the spear pierced. There came the day when Jesus appeared and said, behold, my hands and my side. Never again, this thinking, questioning, doubting Thomas, never again do you find a record of faltering. He fell to his knees, said, my Lord and my God. Thus traditions have him pierce the Himalayas to take the message of Christ to the most philosophic of worlds, where the Vedanta and Buddhist faith have their roots. Ultimately, to be pierced by the best traditions through with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. Cataclysmic change. Now, I believe lying can tell somebody, can change somebody. Seldom for the better. Here you have a man of instability, becomes the rock in faith on which the church is founded. You have sons of thunder, selfish, high-tempered, become sacrificing and symbols of love. You have an agnostic par excellence, doubts everything, with a faith that can tackle the toughest task of taking this message to the most philosophic of world foundations in the Indian four eastern lands. They're changed for the better, whatever your faith. To go from instability to stability is an improvement. To go from rage and selfishness and anger to sacrifice and love is an improvement. To go from doubt and inability to move and crippled agnosticism to a faith that has meaning and that can claim you, makes a better man of you. In every case, these men changed with the telling of this event, and I do not believe a lie changes a person for the better. Three, no man suffers and bears up under the persecution these men bore up under for a lie. The best traditions identify the death. But whatever the tradition, the death was horrible. All save one died a martyr's death. Bartholomew, literally skinned alive with a whip, flayed to death with a whip. Mark, dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria. Peter, crucified upside down. Thomas, as said, pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. One after another, dying a horrible martyr's death for a lie. But that's but the prelude to what St. Thomas Aquinas calls, and my fourth reason, the greatest proof of the resurrection. These all suffered that persecution and died their martyr's death for this testimony alone. Now, stay with me for a moment and I'm finished. I could believe that the power of group pressure would hold a story together. That if for whatever contrived, self-serving, fraudulent purpose, as a group, we agreed to tell a story for our mutual benefit. If you kept us together, there is that gang mentality. We don't want to be the one that breaks first and lets the others down. And if you herded all of these frauds, which we're assuming for a moment, into one room and begin to persecute them, some, maybe all, would die to keep their story intact. But let's separate. No television, no telephone, no telegraph, no instant communication. Each of us, having agreed to tell this story, now separate the different parts of the world. Gary, you be Thomas. You're over in India. You've crossed the Himalayas. Hollister, you be Bartholomew. You're in Armenia. You're going to be skinned to death with a whip. Steve, you be Peter. You're up in Rome. You don't know where Hollister is. You don't know what's happening to Bartholomew. You don't know where Thomas is. You don't know what's happening. And the pressure's on. You're tied to a stake, going to beat you to death with a whip and skin you alive, literally. All you got to do is recant on this story. How is he going to know in India you let him down? And how is Steve going to know in Rome? You can get untied and duck out for another country tomorrow. You're going to be pierced. All you've got to do is renege. How's he going to know? And how's he going to know? And since you're all frauds, for the purpose of this analogy, you're not really caring about the truth. You're not even sure that it's going to become a world movement. You just wanted to protect your own image. Each of you, alone in some far-flung corner of the globe, it is beyond psychological comprehension that one of you, under that kind of pressure, wouldn't break and say, hey, wait a minute, it's been a good fling, but it was all a lie. Not one anywhere in history, dying alone in far-flung corners of the globe, ever backed off the story. For those reasons, I cannot believe these men were lying. My professor, when I went over this with him, said the same thing. He said, you got me convinced, Gene. Those guys believed what they were telling. Therefore, some one of your other facts must be wrong. Well, if I get you here, and these are at issue, I got you. Those are a lot easier than the other one. For those reasons, I believe he came out of the tomb. For those reasons, he has grabbed my life these many years. For those reasons, we have the breath of eternity on us. For those reasons, we dare to take a step like this step to tackle this great city. For those reasons, we know that one day, faith tried in the fire will give us the legal tender, tried in coming forth as pure gold, to spend an eternity. There is a basis for your faith. Thank God, God didn't leave it so objective that we couldn't unite on an objective criteria. You don't have to become a bigot. You don't have to become a traditionalist that believes that because of the resurrection you can't breathe anymore. But you have found a foci for faith. And I am only concerned about one thing, paradoxically, that I won't live long enough to search out better what this one who gave his life for me and rose again, has to say. But paradoxically, I know what Paul said, that death is not the end but the beginning. And he chose the word departure to describe a ship that's laden to start its journey rather than one coming in. And so the paradox resolves, I'll find out all I need to know when we cross over that veil. We're a people that believe in eternal life. We're a people that believe that that eternal life that lets us treat this life as but beginning for the next arms us to face the tasks of this life even better. It creates no superiority. It creates no self-righteousness. It just makes us more tough-minded than some, because we know that this is not all that we have to face, and that how we face down here, what we face, is little alongside what Christ faced, who on a simple promise of the Father offered himself up, that promise being that God would raise him from the dead. We have mountains of promises from that same God, and we hang on because we know that forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven. There is an eternity out there, and when we conflict or find in the crossroads of our life contradictions with God's promises eternal, we just stick our head up and stick our hand up through the fog and grab hold of God's promise and say, we're going to become the conductor of life eternal. We will claim God's word is more real than the world around us, and we will hang on until we die and wake up where God's word reigns supreme, or we change the facts down here. Thank God he lets us have the joy of changing a few things down here. We're bringing life to this place. We're not the only ones, but we're going to do it as though we're the only ones. If everyone else quits, we are coming to the city of the angels with this message of resurrection life, and that's why we're here. Come on, stranger in town again, John. I'll see you next Sunday.